Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Outlook Live conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you have a question at that time, you can press star and zero on your touch-tone phone, and you may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during this call, please press star and zero. As a reminder, the conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Mr. Alex Kounouzenis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance topics. My name is Alex Kounouzenis, and I'm the Consumer Compliance Risk Coordinator at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. I'm happy to be moderating today's conference call on what I would say is a very exciting and timely topic, the new final overdraft rules that were released just last month and go into effect on July 1st, 2010. To help us understand the Federal Reserve's new rules and answer any questions that you may have, we're lucky to have Federal Reserve Board of Governors legal staff, David Stein, Managing Counsel, and Dana Miller, attorney, with us today. Before I hand things over to David and Dana, I just want to say a few words about the call and mention some administrative and logistical details. This is our first of an ongoing series of calls focused specifically on consumer compliance issues. We're calling the program Outlook Live. This is a Federal Reserve System initiative and is being produced in conjunction with our quarterly newsletter, Consumer Compliance Outlook. If you'd like to sign up for the Outlook newsletter or access it online, it's available at consumercomplianceoutlook.org. And definitely stay tuned for future calls where we'll be addressing new rules, hot topics, and other compliance issues. As with the presentation today, future calls will draw on expertise from the Board of Governors as well as the 12 regional reserve banks. Today's format is for David to provide some brief background of the rule and then Dana to walk us through a presentation of the details. We'll have about 20 minutes prepared remarks and then the remainder of the hour for the question and answer session. During the Q&A, we'll be taking questions by email and live from the phones. Instructions for calling in will be provided at the time, and email questions can be sent at any time during the call to the mailbox provided with your registration. I just want to quickly mention that in the lead-up to this call, we received really a tremendous number of questions. I would say the majority of these we made a special point to try to address directly in the presentation. But while we'll attempt to address as many questions as possible during the call, especially those issues or questions raised by multiple people, we may not be able to get to everything. Please understand that our time today is limited, and we may not have the ability to respond to every question that's posed. Well, I actually think that wraps up my introductory remarks. So with that, David, I'll turn things over to you.
Thank you, Alex, and good afternoon to everyone who's participating in this call. I'd like to begin with a brief background on how we got to where we are today with regard to overdraft services. As many of you, I'm sure, know, overdraft services began as an ad hoc way of covering checks when consumers did not have enough money in their account. This was originally done on a manual basis for consumers who had an existing relationship with the bank. Two developments, however, greatly expanded the prevalence of overdraft services. The first was the automation of the overdraft decision-making process. And second, with the introduction of automation, overdraft programs were expanded beyond checks to include debit card, ATM, and other types of electronic transactions. These two developments resulted in an increase in the availability and use of overdrafts by consumers, as well as an increase in overdraft fees paid by consumers. As a result, certain concerns were raised about overdraft services, specifically regarding their transparency and disclosures to consumers and the fees charged to consumers. As a result of these concerns, in 2005, the Federal Reserve Board, along with the other banking agencies, began to take a number of steps to try to address these concerns. Specifically, the banking agencies issued interagency guidance on overdraft protection. Shortly after that, the board published revisions to Regulation DD, which implements the Truth in Savings Act. Both of these, the guidance and the regulations, addressed disclosure and marketing of overdraft services, and both were designed to improve the transparency of overdraft services and fees. Despite these steps taken by regulators, concerns about overdraft services persisted. Therefore, in May 2008, a proposal was issued under the Federal Trade Commission Act, which, among other things, would have prohibited overdraft fees unless the consumer was given notice and the right to opt out, and the consumer did not opt out. This opt-out proposal applied to all types of transactions, including check transactions, although it would have required institutions to give the consumer the option of opting out only of the payment of overdrafts for ATM withdrawals and debit card transactions at point of sale. In addition, contemporaneous with the FTC Act proposal, the board issued proposed revisions to Regulation DD to strengthen the disclosure requirements relating to overdraft fees. The board did not go forward with the FTC Act proposal, but instead published a revised proposal under Regulation E in the Federal Register in January 2009. This rule was finalized in November, and Dana and I will discuss it in some detail on today's call. There were two primary reasons why we did not go forward with the FTC Act proposal. First, the FTC Act proposal, if finalized, would not have covered all depository institutions. State chartered credit unions specifically would not have been covered by that proposal. Secondly, consumer testing participants indicated that they wanted their checks paid because checks are used by them to pay their important bills. And thus, consumers told us through testing that they would not opt out if it meant not getting their checks paid. Also in January of 2009, the board published final revisions to Regulation DD to improve fee disclosures. And these rules become effective on January 1st, 2010. With this introduction, I will now turn it over to my colleague Dana Miller, who will discuss first the final Regulation DD rules, which go into effect next month, as well as the final Reg E rules on overdrafts, which we issued just last month. Dana?
Thank you, David, and good afternoon to everybody. We thought it would be timely to touch on Regulation DD first before moving on to Regulation E because it is effective shortly, and starting on slide 4. There are two components to the Regulation DD final rule. First, the rule requires all depository institutions to disclose on periodic statements aggregate costs of the overdraft service for the statement period and for the year to date. On slide 4, you'll see the model form shown. And you'll note that the disclosure is in a box with grid lines, which is what we would expect to see on periodic statements. We came to this tabular format based on consumer testing, and we had proposed, in fact, two alternative disclosures and found that consumers found the format that that board adopted easiest and clearest to read and understand. Turning to slide 5, the second component of the Regulation DD final rule is that institutions must disclose a balance that does not include amounts that the institution may provide to cover overdrafts. This applies to balance inquiries made through any automated system, including ATMs or going online to check your balance via telephone, et cetera. Amounts from overdraft lines of credit and linked accounts also need to be excluded from that balance. The institution may provide another balance that includes available overdraft funds, so long as there's a prominent statement that the balance includes those amounts, and if applicable, that those amounts are not available for all transactions. And as I mentioned, the rule is effective January 1st, 2010. I'm now going to turn to Regulation E and spend the balance of my time on the overdraft rules published by the board in November. Slide 8 describes the board's proposed rule. The board proposed to prohibit financial institutions from charging overdraft fees for ATM and one-time debit card transactions unless the consumer is given notice and a choice regarding the payment of overdrafts and the consumer chooses to have the overdrafts paid. The proposed rule was limited to ATM and one-time debit card transactions. We found through testing that consumers want their important bills paid and that the consequences for having checks, ACH, and recurring debit card transactions returned are the same, if not worse, than overdrawing the account. The board proposed both an opt-in and an opt-out approach. And with respect to the opt-in, the board proposed to apply the opt-in to all customers, but solicited comment on a hybrid approach. That is, that the opt-in would be applied to new customers and the opt-out would be applied to existing customers. We received over 20,700 comments, approximately 16,000 of which were from form letters, and we received comments from a variety of parties. Returning to slide 9, describe the final rule. The final rule contains an opt-in approach for all consumers, including existing account holders. The board adopted an opt-in for all consumers for a few reasons. For example, customer turnover rate is low, and so this would mean that a large number of consumers would not otherwise receive the enhanced protections of the opt-in. Also, a different approach for new customers and existing customers could cause customer confusion issues if an existing customer, for example, opens up a new account and then has an existing and the new account treated differently. The final rule has four requirements that must be met before consumers can be charged overdraft fees for ATM and one-time debit card overdrafts. They must be provided an opt-in notice segregated from other information. They must be provided a reasonable opportunity to opt in. They must affirmatively consent to the overdraft service for these types of transactions, and they must be provided written confirmation of that choice. The rule also provides consumers an ongoing right to affirmatively consent and to revoke that consent. The final rule also contains a substantially revised model form that has been streamlined to highlight key points and to explain the opt-in concept. We engaged in a number of rounds of consumer testing and drew to a large extent from that testing in order to revise the form as it was finalized. Starting on slide 10, I'll just explain how the rule applies. The final rule does not apply to checks, ACH, or recurring debits. As I mentioned earlier, we found through testing that consumers want these transactions paid because they represent the consumer's important bills. Of course, banks can still offer an opt-in or opt-out choice for those transactions. Some institutions commented during the comment period that they cannot currently distinguish between one-time and recurring transactions. In fact, merchants can code payments with a recurring payment indicator, which as of now has been used for interchange or stop payment implications. We understand that institutions have not previously been focused on that field. And so the final rule has a safe harbor. In order to comply, institutions have to put systems in place to be able to identify that field, that is, whether or not a transaction is a recurring transaction. But once they do that, they may rely on how the merchant codes the transaction as either one-time or recurring. Turning to slide 11, the final rule includes two provisions designed to ensure that consumers do not feel compelled to opt in, and therefore to ensure that consumers have a meaningful choice with respect to the overdraft service. First, the final rule prohibits financial institutions from requiring consumers to opt into the overdraft service for ATM and one-time debit card transactions in order to have checks, ACH, and other types of transactions paid. We refer to this as conditioning the opt-in. The conditioning rule also prohibits institutions from declining to pay checks and other transactions just because a consumer has not opted in. In other words, an institution must apply the same criteria for deciding whether to pay an ATM or one-time debit card transaction into overdraft, whether or not somebody opts in. Of course, institutions are not required to pay overdrafts in all circumstances. The rule just prohibits the tying of one to the other. The second provision that is designed to provide meaningful choice requires institutions to provide consumers who do not opt in with the same account terms, conditions, and features as provided to consumers who do opt in. For example, an institution could not charge consumers who do not opt in a monthly maintenance fee on an account while providing consumers who do opt in the same account free of charge. Turning to slide 14, under the final rule, banks cannot charge fees unless the consumer has been provided notice and provided an opt-in. The final rules do not have any exceptions to this fee prohibition, although the final rule permits institutions to collect the amount of the overdraft. As slide 15 explains, the final rule does have a provision under Section 205.17b4 accepting institutions that have a policy and practice of declining to authorize and pay transactions when the institution has a reasonable belief that the consumer has insufficient funds. We've received a number of questions about this, so I want to spend some time talking about how this actually works. The exception is an exception from the requirements to provide an opt-in notice, get the opt-in, send the written confirmation, et cetera, the whole process. This means that if the institution has the policy and practice of declining to authorize and pay transactions on the insufficient funds, the institution is not required to go through the exercise of sending out the notice, getting the opt-in, et cetera. There would be no point to requiring this for a program the bank does not, as a general matter, participate in. However, this exception is not an exception from the prohibition of charging fees for paying ATM and one-time debit card overdrafts. Let me provide several examples of what this means. An institution may authorize a one-time debit card transaction on good funds, and before the transaction settles, an intervening transaction posts. When the debit card transaction comes in for settlement, it settles into insufficient funds. In that case, the institution may collect the amount of the overdraft, but may not charge a fee. The board, in thinking about this, determined that consumers have made a choice not to opt in. And so to then be charged a fee notwithstanding that choice could be contrary to that expectation and at a minimum be very confusing to the consumer. Let me provide another example. Take a small dollar transaction that's not submitted for authorization. If at settlement this transaction overdraws the account, the institution may not charge a fee. These types of small dollar transactions are a large source of the problem because overdraft fees in these cases can substantially exceed the amount of the transaction. And an exception would permit fees for these transactions, which would be contrary to what we're trying to accomplish with this rule. Well, let me give two other brief examples of how this could work. For example, if an ATM is offline, a bank may permit a withdrawal of a few hundred dollars. You know, it's a typical stand-in situation. If the transaction turns out to overdraw the account once they're back online, the fee may not be charged. Finally, a gas station may submit an authorization request for $1, which the bank will approve. The merchant later submits a payment request for $35 for the gas that was pumped. Under current processor rules, the bank must pay that transaction. However, if the transaction overdraws the account, again, the bank may collect the amount of the overdraft from the consumer, but an overdraft fee may not be charged. We understand that neither party, that the financial institution or the consumer, has perfect information in this case. And in these examples, the payment systems are not transparent to the consumer. With PIN debit, there's practically no lag time, but with signature debit, there could be a delay in settlement, and we do understand this. The system, you know, could be improved so that settlement occurs more quickly, and the board believes that financial institutions are in a better position to continue developing improved processing and updating systems than consumers. And institutions have already done this in the past, and we expect we'll continue to do this. Finally, just want to provide a few words on the effective date, starting on slide 15. The mandatory compliance date for this rule is July 1st, 2010. This means that for new customers who are new on or after July 1st, notice and opt-in is required before overdraft fees may be assessed. For existing customers, we recognize the need for some transition period for consumers to explore other alternatives, to learn a little bit more about what it is that they would be making a choice about. So for those accounts, the existing customers, for any existing customer who has not opted in by August 15th, the institution will need to shut off the fees unless they provide a notice and obtain the consumer's affirmative consent. And with that, we can open it up to questions.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks, Dana. At this point, we'll have the operator provide call-in instructions and get the phone queue set up.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star and zero on your touch-tone phone. You will hear an acknowledgement tone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. And if you would please limit yourself to two questions. Once again, if you have a question, press star and zero at this time. A few moments, please, for the first question.
Okay. As people are beginning to call in, let's start with a few email questions that we received prior to the call and that we've been getting during the call up to this point. David or Dana, the first question I have, or actually I have a number of questions that have to do with the one-time debit card transactions. I'll read two that are kind of related. The first one here just basically says, what is meant by one-time debit card transactions? And then the related question says, what is the definition of a recurring debit card transaction? Is there a specified frequency? Must it be for the same amount each time that it recurs? Can you provide examples of recurring and one-time transactions?
Thank you, Alex. A recurring debit card transaction is a pre-authorized electronic fund transfer using a debit card number. For example, a consumer might provide a gym his or her debit card number for the monthly membership fee, and the gym runs that debit card number every month. A one-time transaction or other types of individual transactions using a debit card. For example, you use a debit card to make a purchase at CVS or at Starbucks.
Terrific. I have another question here. There's a couple questions that have to do with sort of the opt-in process, I guess I would say. Let me read the first one here. It says, is the opt-in intended to be at the card level, an account level, or customer level? For instance, if a consumer has more than one account, does he have to respond to a notice for each account or each card, or just a one-time overall option of, this is how I want my account's cards to be handled? And the related question here is, we would like to know if it would be permissible for the consent form to cover multiple accounts or if separate consent forms are required for each account.
Thank you. An opt-in is separately required for each account. So if a consumer has several accounts, the consumer needs to opt in separately for each of those accounts. The consumer might want to have different accounts treated differently. For example, they may want to opt in with respect to – a consumer might want to opt in with respect to his own account, but may not want to provide an opt-in for a joint account with his teenager. And with only one form, the consumer might be confused or might believe that in order to opt in with respect to his or her individual account, you know, she needs to opt in for all accounts, which may not be the preference. So you need to get a separate opt-in for each account.
Sounds good. I've got one last email question maybe we can do here before we move to the phone queue. The question is, the model form has a place for the customer to opt out or opt in to the electronic channels. Since all consumers are automatically opted out, do we only need the form to provide the opt-in option?
The model form provided a line that says, I do not want to opt in or something to that effect. That checkbox for consumers to decline to opt in is optional. We included it because some research suggests that consumers want to see a no choice along with the yes choice.
Okay, terrific. Operator, why don't we move to the phone lines now and take a couple of questions live.
Thank you. And your first question comes from the line of Karen Drake. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Two questions. On the area that requires the total overdraft fees and year-to-date, month-to-date on the statement, must it be boxed?
Yes, it should be boxed. We should see a grid box.
Okay. And on your slide number 10, the bottom area, you mentioned something about safe harbor to be able to ID whether a transaction is a recurring debit transaction or a one-time for the merchants to be able to code those. Mm-hmm. What is the date for that safe harbor?
I don't understand. What do you mean by what is the date? The effective date of that?
Mm-hmm.
Is the date of the effective date of the rule, mandatory compliance date.
Okay, so you said something about safe harbor. I thought you meant there would be like an extended period for those merchants to be able to code those transactions. That is not the case?
This is David. No, this rule doesn't impose any obligations on merchants. The purpose of the safe harbor is to recognize that the banks will be getting transactions presented by merchants. Some merchants will properly code it as a recurring transaction.
Right.
And some merchants will not properly code it. The purpose of the safe harbor is to enable banks to treat transactions that are not coded as recurring transactions as one-time transactions, even if it's the merchant who did not properly.
Okay. So if they don't code it, we're not obligated to figure out if it is a recurring or not.
That's correct. Your
okay.
obligation is simply to look for that code, and if it is coded as recurring, to treat it as you would treat a check or an ACH transaction.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And your next question comes from the line of Kathy Burrows. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is in regard to the exception to notice and opt-in requirements. I'm wondering if it's permissible to notify customers 30 days prior to enacting this that we would no longer, and this would be prior to the July 1st date, that we would no longer in 30 days or more that we'll no longer authorize or pay transactions at the ATM or one-time debit card withdrawals and change our practices. Would that be permissible?
So if I understand, you're asking whether you could provide a notice, say, June 15th, that's after July 1st or after a certain date, you will not be paying those types of transactions anymore?
Correct.
The rule contemplates that some financial institutions might want to start sending notices before July 1st, for example, with statements that go out in June. And because of that, we've built in the flexibility in the model form to say that the consumer's choice would apply after August 15th or July 15th or whatever date you choose. You need to know to be very clear in your communications about this.
I guess my question is, if we changed our practices, if we no longer allowed ATM withdrawals and one-time debit card transactions to overdraw accounts, would that be permissible as long as we gave sufficient notification?
Yeah, as long as you give an appropriate change in terms notice.
Okay.
In accordance with Regulation E, you can, of course, change your policy.
Great. That's what I wondered. Thank you.
Thank you. And your next question comes from the line of Karen Spence. Please go ahead.
Hello there.
Hello.
We have overdraft lines of protection, complete with promissory note or credit agreement, the whole bit. We don't charge NSF fees, although there is the finance charge, which if they use it, which is on the periodic statement. I would like someone to explain to me the rationale behind not being allowed to include that on an available balance at an ATM.
The purpose of creating, you can include those amounts in an additional balance if you provide a second balance, but the purpose behind requiring a balance that excludes those funds is that the consumer, it could be potentially confusing or misleading to the consumer if they think that those are the funds that they actually have in their account. And we wanted to present to the consumers what do they actually have. If they had, say, a $150 line of credit on top of the funds in their account and they saw, let's say, the $200 in their account and they saw a $350 balance, they may actually think that they had $350 and may unintentionally overdraw their account because they think they had more funds than they actually had.
So we're regulating people that don't balance their checkbooks.
Well, no. What we're doing is we're recognizing that both the bank and the consumer have imperfect information. I mean, many banks have told us that we don't have real-time balances. We push out a balance from the beginning of the day. We also have consumers who don't know exactly when checks are going to clear. So when they see a balance, they may have an expectation that the bank has better information than they do, which is not always the case. So we're simply trying to make clear that the funds that the consumer actually has available for use without incurring a fee, that's what goes in the first balance. For any other sort of protection, whether it's a link to a savings account or an overdraft line of credit, that can be included as a second balance, but the consumer should know that if they're going to tap into those funds, that's going to trigger, you know, whatever fees are associated with those programs.
Okay, fine. I know how much is in my account all the time, but that's fine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Troy Richards. Please go ahead.
Yes, I have a question about the exception to notice and opt-in. We are a bank that does not currently offer any sort of overdraft line through ATM and debit card. However, that does not preclude inadvertent overdrafts from occurring, as you mentioned in several of your examples. The exception basically tells us you don't have to send out a opt-in notice, but you can't charge any fees. for those. We would like to charge fees for those, but the only way we can is through some sort of an opt-in notice. What sort of opt-in notice can I send out in order to be able to charge those fees?
You could send out the opt-in notice that accurately describes what you will do, that's in, compliant with the model form that we included in the final rule.
But we are not offering the service of authorizing debit card transactions into the overdraft, and we don't want to start doing that. But I want to be able to charge for these fees, for these transactions that do come in. So the model notice doesn't work for my situation, because I'm not going to start putting the overdraft line out there for them to draw on, but I want to charge for the ones that come in, like the gas station ones and the below-the-floor limit transactions.
Well, you know, we did not contemplate that banks would continue charging overdraft fees for below-the-floor limit transactions. I mean, we think there are other ways to, that the system, the payment system could be modified so that you don't wind up authorizing those, but...
We don't authorize those.
Yes,
but yet we have to pay them when they come in because we cannot send those back by visa regulations. And I want to be compensated for the risk that I incur by overdrawing accounts. So what does my opt-in notice need to look like without offering them an opt-in of having access to this on their debit card?
We did not contemplate that people would provide opt-in, would seek opt-ins in this circumstance.
Well, I mean, that's what it's come down to.
Well, what it comes down to is you don't charge the fee.
So you're saying the only way that I can charge a fee is that if I all of a sudden start letting them access credit overdraft limits through their debit card and let them opt in for that service. But if I'm not providing the service that caused all of this problem in the first place, then there's no way I can charge any fees. I have to start offering a service that I don't want to offer in order to be able to charge the fee.
I don't think that's entirely accurate, but I think you would need, in order to be able to charge the fee, you would need to get the consumer's consent to charge that fee. And so I think your question is, how could you...
I mean, does my opt-in notice need to say, dear customer, would you allow us to charge you an NSF fee? Or, you know, because allowing them to opt in for me to pay their overdrawn debit card fees doesn't make any sense because we have to pay those debit card transactions. You can't opt in or opt out of something that we have to do. So, again, what does my opt-in notice need to say or look like?
I think this is getting into a particularly technical point. It might be best to sort of maybe deal with this question separately offline so we can handle some other questions.
I figured.
Does he have the contact?
Yeah, if you can give us some contact information, we'll be happy to do that.
Actually, if you could just send an email to the email box you got with your registration, that'd probably be the easiest way, and then we can get back to you.
I've already sent an email question regarding this.
Okay, terrific. Well, I think we can handle it that way then.
So you're going to email me back?
Yes.
That's fine.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. If we could then move on to the next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Rob Givens. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. One thing that's not clear to me is the distinction between an overdraft fee and an NSF fee.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help? Because we don't charge an overdraft fee. The item is written, it hits the account, there's no money in the account, we charge an NSF fee. Then we elect under certain criteria to either pay it or not pay it with no interest, with no fee, with no condition. You know, if the account's been open 90 days and they haven't caused any other kind of problems, they just get the service. So when you start saying, like, on no exceptions to fee prohibition, the bank cannot charge overdraft fees unless we've gotten the opt-in, we don't charge an overdraft fee. Does this overdraft fee apply to an NSF fee for which I have no control? The consumer can write as many non-sufficient drafts or ATM transactions as they choose. And I incur costs for every single one of those. So am I prohibited from NSF fees or from overdraft fees?
Thank you. If it's a fee that's charged for paying a transaction that overdraws the account, which in your example is an NSF fee, we consider that an overdraft fee regardless of how you label it. Whether you label it an overdraft fee or an NSF fee, it's still a fee that's charged for paying the transaction.
No, it's not. It's a fee for having insufficient funds in the account.
But you
that's all. We charge the fee when there's no funds in the account.
Well,
and then subsequent to that, we say, you're a good long-term member. We'll give you the advantage of going ahead and paying that. But there's no incremental cost for paying that item. We could just as easily say, we're not going to pay the item, and that same NSF fee would accrue.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, how can you make the decision after the fact if it's a debit card transaction or an ATM transaction? I mean, your scenario sounds like a check transaction where you can pay it and then decide whether or not you're going to return it.
It generally is, and I guess to the point of the gentleman before us, we do not allow overdrafts at ATMs, and we don't allow overdrafts for one-time debits, but there are some of those things that occur.
And so
that's that same issue, and it'll help if you can clarify that for him, you clarify it for all of us. But it's less about the one-time options than it is about the distinction between an overdraft fee and an NSF fee.
Well, we don't make that distinction. I mean, if you look at our final DD rules, which go into effect next month, we require totals for two categories of fees, total overdraft fees and total returned item fees.
A returned item can be a return deposit. You're talking about exclusively return debits.
No, I'm talking about return checks, returned ACH. I mean.
Okay, but those are debits. Those aren't credits.
Right.
Okay. So for those, that's an NSF fee.
Yeah, but we don't call it an NSF fee in Reg DD. We don't kind of deal with that, use that terminology in the Reg E rule. So, I mean, the question is, are you paying the are you charging the fee and returning the item to the merchant? Or are you charging the fee but still covering the transaction for the consumer?
The latter.
Okay. Well, the latter is an overdraft fee. It doesn't matter what label you put on it.
Not to the consumer, it's not. I think that's where there's some huge flaws in your approach, is not to distinguish between those two. Because the easy answer is we'll just stop covering the overdraft. The consumer is going to incur exactly the same charges. They're just not going to get the benefit of the coverage.
Well, that is true.
So
checks.
good job by the government for the consumer.
Just let me finish here. That's true for checks. And that's true for ACH transactions, which is why those types of transactions are not covered by this opt-in rule. However, if a consumer goes to a grocery store with a debit card or goes to an ATM, swipes the card, and there's not enough money in the account, the transaction is declined, assuming that authorization has been submitted, and the consumer incurs no fee.
Well, it's declined, as you stated, the distinction between PIN and signature debit. It may be approved signature debit and then declined when it hits us.
Right. And as I think we've stated before, that we realize that signature debit works a little bit differently, but we think there's room for both the banks, you know, the networks, payment card networks, merchants to work together to improve the signature card network to make it work, you know, to make settlement and much closer in time. So I think we have to move on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And your next question is from the line of Susan Stewart. Please go ahead.
Hi there. We have two questions. The first one we want to clarify, when we send an opt-in notice to our existing customers, if they send it back that they're opting in to the overdraft program, we want to clarify, are we obligated to send them a written confirmation back?
Yes, you must send a written confirmation back. You can either choose to send it a letter or choose to send a copy of the, if it's easier for you, to send a copy of the opt-in notice with their election that's made.
Okay, thank you. And the next one?
Well, we have an email question that we'd like to go to. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me let you finish, and then we'll...
Yeah, we had one more question.
That's fine. I would just want to get some, let some of the email people ask, but go ahead.
Oh, yes, thanks.
Okay, if the customer has overdraft protection from a savings or a line of credit, do they also have to opt in order to have that done for ATM one-time point of sale?
No.
Okay, so they've already signed up for their service. We're okay.
They have signed up for it and presumably know the fees and other details associated with that type of program. So, no, you do not need to separately obtain an opt-in for that.
Okay.
However, let me just put this caveat there. You know, it is possible that a consumer might use up all of the money in their savings account. And at that point, if the consumer has not opted in, you would not be able to charge a fee if they use up all the money in their checking account and all the money in their savings account.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And your next question comes from the line of Marty Spencer. Please go ahead.
Yeah, my question was, if we have a situation where we have account overdrawn for a number of days, and we typically maybe, let's say at the fifth day, charge NSF fee of, let's say, $5, if that overdraft was a result of one of these $1 charges at a gas station, is that a fee that can be charged that the customer has not opted in?
So it's specifically due to a debit card overdraft?
Yes.
No. You have to get an opt-in to be able to charge an extended sustained overdraft fee, daily fee.
Okay. Now, if that overdraft situation was a result of purely checks, ACH, et cetera, not debit or ATM, then the fee could be charged.
That's right.
All right. Thank you.
I'd like to turn to an email question now that we've gotten. And let me just read this. Presently, we include a description of our overdraft service in our account agreement. Will we be required to remove this description from our account agreement, or will we be able to leave it in the agreement as long as we also provide a standalone notice describing our overdraft service? The requirement in the rule is that the opt-in notice be segregated from other information. That does not necessarily mean it can't be sort of, you know, included with account opening materials. However, it would need to be sort of set out separately. You would not need to eliminate your description from the account agreement so long as it's accurate. But the other thing to keep in mind, it would not be permissible to include the opt-in notice in your account agreement and treat the signature at the bottom of the account agreement as the consumer opting in. You'd have to separately get the consumer to check a box or initial that part of the agreement that says, you know, yes, I want to opt in to the overdraft service. We can go back to a caller question.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Lori Moore. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Lori, and we have a situation where we have real-time balances delivered to for our debit card users. It's PIN only, so almost every time they're going to show the actual balance that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't offer an overdraft. Do you think that we would be required to do an opt-in or opt-out?
I'm trying to understand the question. I'm sorry.
Okay. What I'm saying is they're not going to see they're only going to see their real-time balance, which would mean if they have $20 in their account, you know, that's what the vendor is going to see. So they're going to be at that point authorized or not authorized, you know, on the balance that they see. So we're not actually paying anything in overdraft.
The prohibition is a prohibition on charging fees without obtaining an opt-in. So if you're not if the consumer is not overdrawing their account and if it's real time and there are no situations where there might be an intervening transaction which may cause the account to go into overdraft, then presumably you won't be charging any fees because there won't be any overdraft. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would think that would be completely accurate. And we do charge, you know, fees at our end-of-day process where, you know, but that's with already the charges coming in from any debit card transactions that have happened that day. They wouldn't have been allowed to pay except for maybe in a stand-in situation on a balance, you know, that wasn't there.
But for the stand-in situation, for any situation where you want to charge a fee, so if at the end of the day there are those types of transactions, if you want to charge a fee, you need to obtain the consumer's opt-in.
Okay, but we would never charge a fee actually on a debit card transaction. So I guess we wouldn't need to. And we would charge a fee on like a check that came in after that or an ACH of some kind, but we wouldn't have the chance or the situation to charge a fee per item on a debit card transaction.
Except in those stand-in situations?
Well, not even then because it's not going to come in our end-of-day process. So I'm thinking that we wouldn't need to send them an opt-in or opt-out, and I'm just trying to get verification of that.
I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but
okay.
The bottom line is if you're not going to ever charge a consumer for paying an overdraft,
mm-hmm.
either if they can't overdraw their account, or if they do overdraw because of some confluence of events, you are not going to charge them a fee,
right?
Then you would not need to go through the notice
the opt-in and
process.
Opt-out. Okay, and I have one more question. We are like the one of the other bankers that you talked to. At times on our other items, I'm talking about the Reg DD, where our statement needs to have the little grid in there.
Mm-hmm.
We charge the same fee if we actually pay the item or not. So what we're proposing to do is month-to-date, year-to-date, and what we say on our disclosures and on this new disclosure on our new statements January 1st, we're saying NSF fee item paid, NSF fee returned. And you think that we'd be all right with that disclosure?
We permitted, in lieu of saying returned item fee, to use NSF fee because people sometimes use that nomenclature. The model form does say overdraft fee for fees
mm-hmm.
that we would consider overdraft fees.
But we don't offer overdraft, so we don't want to say overdraft. We do sometimes pay items just on a customer basis, you know.
Again, we would consider that an overdraft fee. So I think we want to get away from trying to use labels to distinguish. If it's a fee for paying an item, it is, in our view, an overdraft fee.
But our account disclosure does not say overdraft on anything, and we were told that if you say it on your account disclosure, then you need to say exactly that on your statement. So our account disclosure says NSF item paid, NSF item returned. So we think that we should have that in our little box.
I think we'd need to...
I think we need to sort of take that offline again. There's benefit for consumers, no matter where they're doing business, to getting seeing the same box and the same disclosure. Having overdraft mean the same thing at all institutions. So,
but what we want to, you know, stay away from is claiming that we have any kind of an overdraft policy at all. So I'll email it to you.
Okay. That's good.
That would be good.
That's good. Why don't we go back to an email question here, if we can, and I'll let Dana tackle this. I'll just read the question. What about customers who have already opted out? Do we have to resend an opt-in notice to them?
The answer is no.
Opted out.
If they've opted out.
I think the answer depends upon what have they opted out of. There are a number of institutions who have opt-out policies today that do not sort of comply with all of the requirements of our Reg E rule. For example, they may apply to all transactions, checks, including debit card and ATM. They may, so that would violate our no conditioning rule. Also, we have an opt-in requirement now, so an existing opt-out is not the same thing. So for those institutions who have existing policies that are not consistent with what this new rule requires, they would need to send new opt-in notices to consumers as of, and put that in place as of the effective date. We can go back to the phones if anyone has.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Woody Hodgson. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to just first compliment you all on holding this little training. And I think it sounds like Outlook Live is new, but I'd like to suggest that we do this for every single change to every single reg. It's very helpful. But I wanted to make sure that I understood correctly that if we have existing members and we mail out an opt-out notice to them and they fill it out and mail it back to us, is that true that you said that we then need to copy that and send them in the mail a copy of their opt-in?
You have to provide a written confirmation. That's one of the four requirements in order to start charging fees. The written confirmation can be a letter. It could also just, for ease of compliance, can be a copy of what they sent to you.
Okay.
The purpose is so that the consumer knows and has a record of their choice.
Okay. So we don't count on them to keep a copy before they mail it back in then, necessarily.
Well, the copy is...
Well, and also one thing that we learned from consumer testing is that many consumers, if they choose to exercise a choice, will choose to do so by telephone.
Okay.
So, for those consumers, they wouldn't really, it would be nice for them to get some sort of confirmation that telephone process worked.
Got it. Okay, so they can opt in by phone.
By phone, could do it. You can have people allow people to opt in through your website.
Okay.
You have a fair amount of flexibility there.
Although, to be clear, the opt-in notice must be provided, the opt-in notice itself must be provided in writing or, if the consumer agrees, electronically.
Right.
So you could not call and read the opt-in form to the consumer and get their opt-in that way.
Yeah, okay. Then if they call and do the web, any of that other stuff, we send them a written confirmation.
Yes.
That's right.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Jamie Clay. Please go ahead.
Yes, this question has already, I think, been answered, but I want to make sure. On the Reg BD changes, that tabular format, it absolutely has to be in the tabular format, right? Because we have those disclosures on our periodic statement, but they're not in a table. They're, in close proximity to each other, but they're not actually in that table format. And our technology company said it would be kind of hard for them to actually get it in a true table.
We would expect to see a table. We did consumer testing on the different proposed options, and this was the one that consumers found to be the easiest and clearest to read. There are, ways to approximate a table if you're using a dot matrix printer, for example, but characters, lines, dashes, but...
And I have one other question. I think this one has already been answered too, but I'll just to be on the safe side, if we wanted to thought that overall we just will not pay, allow overdrafts on like ATM transactions and one-time POS transactions for all customers,
mm-hmm.
we can do that if we give notice, right?
Say that one more time.
If we won't allow ATM transactions and one-time debit transactions to overdraw their account, if we give notice, we can do that. Like, we won't do the opt-in. We'll just say we're not going for it. We're not going to allow these types of transactions to overdraw your account.
I'm not clear on what you mean by you won't allow.
When you say you won't, are you talking about a change in terms? Are you changing your policy?
Yes.
Okay, then if you change your policy, you would have to, if you change your policy from what it is today, as you adjust to this new rule, you would need to do a change in terms notice. However, you know, as we've discussed throughout this call, you know, we think most institutions will not be able to completely stop in all circumstances paying some overdrafts. So there, in that case, your choice is either you'd have to, you know, not charge a fee,
right?
In which case you don't need to send the opt-in notice. But if you did want to charge fees,
you'd have to
send an opt-in notice, and then it might not make sense to change your policy, quite frankly.
Right. Okay, you've answered both my questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, it looks like we only have a few minutes left of our scheduled time. Given the large number of email questions we've gotten, I'd like to just pose a few more of those before we conclude. The question I have here is, in the final ruling, banks must disclose on periodic statements the aggregate costs of the overdraft service for the statement period and calendar year to date. Some banks charge a daily overdraft charge when the account remains overdrawn. The regulation does not appear to discuss that daily fee in the disclosure, only the fee for creating the overdraft or returning the NSF. How is the daily overdraft fee to be handled on the periodic statement?
Thank you. The daily overdraft fees, sustained overdraft fees, should be included in the overdraft fee total. If you look at, to be technical here, if you look at comment 230.11A1-4, which is from the 2005 Reg DD revisions, the box is to include a total dollar amount for all fees charged for paying overdrafts, and we list in that comment different types of fees that we'd expect to see in the overdraft fee bucket. Returned item fees are itemized separately, that is, fees when a check or ACH bounces and the institution returns it to the merchant. That would be in the returned item fee NSF fee bucket of the table.
Perfect. Thanks, Dana. I've got another question here that says, the reg says the fees noticed must be substantially similar to the sample shown. What does substantially similar mean? For example, the reg says returned item fees can be shown as NSF fees. However, it doesn't mention any other wording for total overdraft fees. In the past, we used negative balance fees instead of overdraft fees because it seemed more clear. Is it acceptable to use negative balance fees in place of total overdraft fees?
Thank you. Let me just correct myself on my prior statement. It's comment 2 now under the new rules. It was previously comment 4. It is now comment 2. Again, on the lines that are required, we do expect to see the box and the grid lines.
This is a question we've talked about a little bit before,
yeah,
about the box requiring disclosure of total overdraft fees. And not providing flexibility to substitute. I mean, I think the question you talk about negative balance fees, that's terminology that we would not expect to see in the box.
Okay, terrific. Another question I have here is, will account holders be permitted to choose different options for covered transactions? For example, would I be able to opt in to permit the bank to authorize and pay overdrafts on ATM access, but opt out of everyday debit card transactions?
You could prevent both choices as long as it's clear that there is an opt-in choice for both. You need to make sure that the form very clearly provides those choices.
Okay, terrific. Another question here. One of our customers also banks with a large national bank, and he told us that this bank has already sent an opt-in notice that says if you don't respond, you are automatically opted in. While that might be permissible now, wouldn't you have to send another opt-in notice that would be subject to express written consent for the new rules when they're in effect? In other words, no matter what you do now, you can't grandfather in any customers who previously opted in, correct?
The only way you could grandfather anything in is if the existing process is an opt-in process that complies with all of the requirements that we have in the new regulation. And practically speaking, I would be highly unlikely that any institutions are doing that now. So the answer is no, you would not be able to grandfather those in.
Okay, that makes sense. Another question, although I think you may have already touched on this a little bit, but I've got this in front of me. It says, what rules apply when ATMs are offline and the stand-in balance may not adjust for other deposits or withdrawals?
The institution can collect the amount of the overdraft but cannot charge a fee unless the consumer has opted in.
Do we have, Alex, do we have maybe one or two last calls and then we could caller questions waiting in the queue, and then we could wrap this up.
Sure, that sounds great. Let's go back to the phone lines.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Bob Hunt. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question is about the level at which the policy and practices of declining authorization applies. My impression was that that was an account-level determination, but your description made it sound like it was a bank-level determination. Can you be more clear about that?
Could you provide an example? Yeah, can you repeat the question or state it differently? I don't think
the exception that's in the rule
is
whether or not you have to send out the opt-out opt-in notice if the practice is to not to authorize an overdraft on an account.
I've got your question.
Okay.
Yeah. So we recognize that an individual institution may have some types of accounts for which it has a policy and practice of not paying overdrafts. And it may have other types of accounts where it does have that policy and wants people to opt in. For the first type of account where you have that policy and practice of not paying overdrafts, you would not have to provide an opt-in notice. The exception to the notice and opt-in requirement would apply, but for the type of account where you do pay overdrafts or want to pay overdrafts, you would have to provide the notice. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Nancy McManuels. Please go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Two questions. First one is, this does apply to consumer and commercial or just consumer?
Just consumer.
Just consumer. The other question is, what would possess somebody to opt in? Isn't that just saying, yeah, you can charge me NSF fees?
Let me give you the argument that we heard from many people in industry as we went through the process of developing these rules, and that is, if a consumer takes their debit card to a grocery store or a pharmacy, and they know payday is coming up in a couple of days, but they don't have enough money in their account, but they need those groceries right now, or they need that prescription right now, they may be willing to pay that overdraft fee. They also may be willing to pay that fee to avoid embarrassment, being at the point of sale terminal and then having to put the groceries back. There also may be situations where a customer needs to get money out of the ATM for emergency purposes, and so customers may opt in, for that rather than risk being declined. And that's sort of the industry argument, and I think sort of what consumers will do will really be determined by what kind of how many people opt in.
So if you don't have a practice of paying them, but have to pay them because they're under the floor limit.
Well,
again, what would possess somebody to want to say, yeah, you can charge me NSF fees?
Well, you're talking about one type of transaction. We think, there are many other types of transactions where the merchant would seek authorization, there would not be enough money in the account, and the transaction would be declined if the consumer did not opt in.
So then there wouldn't be an overdraft and the fee wouldn't matter.
But then the consumer would have to put the groceries back on the shelf or, have to leave the prescription at the pharmacy.
Okay.
There is a real difference in terms of, is it a below the floor limit transaction or is it a bigger transaction that requires authorization.
Right. But essentially, the banks are just having to cut fee income. And I know that's not your call, but that's the bottom line of what it's boiling down to. Because if I were a customer, I would never opt in based on the theory that I should know what's in my account. And, I'm not going to try to use the card if I don't have it.
The purpose of this rule is to provide consumers choice and to provide transparency, and that's what we're trying to get.
Yeah, and okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Your next question comes from the line of Teresa Timmons. Please go ahead.
Yes. We have a courtesy pay program, and right now, if we have an opt-in notice signed, does it? Right now, we don't have an obligation to, you know, pay with the courtesy pay program. If the account becomes, you know, a risk situation, with an opt-in notice, does it become an obligation of the institution?
No.
So would that require a change in terms notice if we changed the limit of courtesy pay, or?
I guess it depends on what's in your account agreement. If you have a contractual agreement with the consumer that you're going to be paying transactions, or you make representations that you're going to cover their overdraft, that would be one thing. But if this is a courtesy pay program where it's not disclosed to the consumer in the first place whether or not you're going to be covering it, and if you retain discretion over whether or not you're going, I mean, our understanding.
But doesn't that opt-in notice become one?
No.
No.
In fact, I believe okay. that you'll be paying at their discretion.
There's no guarantee that your
transaction will be paid.
The model notice itself has a statement that any payment of overdrafts is in the discretion of the institution.
Okay.
So that's right in the model notice, and you know, we assume that institutions would include that.
Okay. Thank you.
Which, for those who have asked, the model form can be found in the Federal Register notice.
Okay, well, it looks like we're about 10 minutes over our allotted time, so I think with that, we're going to have to wrap up the call for today. I would definitely like to again thank our presenters, David Stein and Dana Miller. We were very lucky, I think, today to get their expert input on the new rule, and I think we're hopefully able to cover a number of key areas where people had questions. We really hope everyone found this call useful. Just a side point, so we'll be sending everyone who called in today a short feedback form, and we'd definitely appreciate it if you could take just a couple of minutes to let us know what you liked about the call, any suggestions for improvement, and possible topics for future calls. I want to stress the importance of your feedback, not only in ways we can improve these calls, but also in other ways in which we can continue a productive dialogue with the industry. Again, I also urge you to check out our Consumer Compliance Outlook newsletter. Thanks again for joining us. That does conclude our call.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference. You may now disconnect.
Thank you for calling the AT&T Teleconference Replay System.